Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
I want a one-way ticket down to Tennessee. I'm leaving immediately. Chattanooga, here I come. Pardon me, boy. Is that
from WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. You know the tunes? That old black magic, Time After Time, Cheek to Cheek, April in Paris, Chattanooga, Choo Choo. Songs from more than half a century ago that still make us want to put on a top hat, dance under the stars, fall in love. This hour on Point, performer Michael Feinstein and Boston Pops conductor Keith Lockhart on the Great American Songbook. You can join the conversation. What made these classics great? What do they represent? Do you still sing them in the shower? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK, and you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now in the studio is Michael Feinstein, singer, pianist, great American songbook revivalist, and five-time Grammy nominee. He's founder of the Michael Feinstein Foundation for the Preservation of the Great American Songbook in Carmel, Indiana, where he's also artistic director of the Center for the Performing Arts. In 2008, he released the CD The Sinatra Project. Michael Feinstein, great to have you with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And with us in the studio, Keith Lockhart, conductor of the Boston Pops, which will be performing the Great American Songbook with Michael Feinstein tonight and tomorrow. Lockhart is also conductor of the BBC Concert Orchestra. He was music director of the Utah Symphony Orchestra from 98 to 09. Keith Lockhart, it's great to have you right here.
It's great to be here, Tom. Thanks. Hey,
Keith, define this for us. The Great American Songbook, you're playing it. We said earlier on maybe 1910 to rock and roll. We've seen it defined that way. What's in there? What is it?
I think the Great American Songbook is an extremely fluid collection. I don't think it's possible to say it's 1910 to the beginning of rock and roll. I think it's something that's constantly evolving, constantly changing, and I've been thinking a lot about how to define it. And I would say that it is the body of work by American composers and performers that has outlasted the generations it was written for, that still has resonance, still has emotional reality for people who are two or three generations past the people who originally heard it. I think that's what defines it as classic and what puts it into the canon of the Great American Songbook.
We'll talk about whether the sort of back end of it stays open and whether new songs are being added or should be added or will be added to that songbook. But, Michael, when you're singing it, and you're singing it from the heart of the period we think of, and, you know, Chattanooga Choo Choo or Ride On, I mean, there's a lot of music in here written in the 30s and the 40s and earlier. You know, never mind the time frame for a second, but in terms of the qualities of this music, what... You know, when you hear a song and somebody, you know, and you know right away it's in the Great American Songbook or should be, what is it about that song that puts it there?
For me, it's a certain matter of craft and quality. It's not the lineage or the, as you say, the era. It is the craft of what made these songs good. A song is the perfect combination of music and lyric. And that is Ira Gershwin's definition of it. And this material has lasted because it still has resonance for audiences today, and it's a particular brilliant approach to crafting this material that has been lost, I think, through the years. It's like Sondheim, who always writes so extraordinarily with great craft, and it's like doing a very difficult crossword puzzle when you've found the perfect rhymes and the perfect combination to the music. It's not easy to do, but it's like a little gem once it's done, and that I think is the biggest thing, not only the quality, but how people relate to the different expressions of the human condition so eloquently pervade in these songs.
A lot of it comes from early, mid-20th century. Mm-hmm. Now, it's craft, but it's also something about culture. Mm-hmm. You've said that we do or may look back on this period in song in the way that painters and sculptors ultimately looked back on the Italian Renaissance. There was something special going on there in the visual arts. Was there something special going on? Was this a moment in world history, American history, that somehow culturally meant this is what's going to emerge?
Evidently, yes.
What was it?
Certainly the time in our country, it was when the world was changing in many ways, especially with with entertainment and recordings and electronics and mass media. We went from the invention of the phonograph and piano rolls and such to mass communication with radio that made this music and these songs a communal experience in a way that doesn't exist anymore. And also, Broadway was in a golden era where the musical, as it had been evolving, came into its own in the 20s and 30s. Then in the late 20s, talking pictures were suddenly, they were making movies in Hollywood. So it is all those factors that conspired to create a forum for songwriters to create material. And a lot of them came from New York, and it is the New York melting pot and all the experiences that it gave. The desire of many of these writers who were the children of immigrants mm-hmm. to be very American and to soak up the culture and also to be very well educated. There was a respect for education. And so
eloquence. Maybe.
Eloquence, mm-hmm. absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so it's all those factors.
Let's listen to a little bit. This is Michael Feinstein with the Boston Pops, June 20th, 2009. Begin the Begin.
So I only remember when they begin the begin. Oh, yes, let
the love that was once a fire remain an ember. Cole Porter's 1935 from the musical Jubilee. Michael Feinstein there with the Boston Pops. Keith Lockhart, when you're wading into Great American Songbook territory, at least this era, the 30s, and what is it you're looking to bring when you come to interpret this? Is it a matter of time travel? Are you going back and trying to imagine, I don't know, a starlit night in 1935? Does that matter?
No, I think in my mind's eye, I can certainly see, you know, the elegance that Cole Porter portrayed in his songs when I performed. But I think the great thing about
you
songs,
can picture Top Hat and Tails, right?
Yes,
there.
Exactly. I think the great thing about the songs that Michael preserves and that we continue and frankly, that are at pretty much the core of the Boston Pops repertoire. We play the Great American Songbook. We live in it. We also play what you might call the Great American Instrumental Songbook, the mm-hmm. great music of George Gershwin and Leonard Bernstein, Leroy Anderson. I think the great thing about these is that they are fresh again and they live with the person who's performing them. I don't think it's about – there are certain kinds of concerts we do that seem almost archaic by design, where we try to recreate something the way it was then. The great thing about these songs is that they live now.
Why? Are they still being written now?
I think so. This is an interesting question. I think perspective, the definition of classic, you know, I come from the classical music world, and mm-hmm. we define that as, you know, dead composers wearing white powdered wigs pretty much. But what I see it, for me, the definition of classic, as I said, is something that outlives the people, that was written for more generations to come. There is so much music, and incidentally, there was so much music in the 20s and 30s that is throwaway. Music. There is totally, there's music of its time that's popular for a while and goes away and nobody ever cares about it again. So what is it that makes these songs continue to be pulled out, reinterpreted, and still be vibrant?
Michael Feinstein, as a young man, you worked for half a dozen years with Ira Gershwin.
Yes.
Of course, his brother George was long gone by that time. But do you think, did he say when he was writing, you know, when they were writing decades earlier, was he writing for the ages or was he just a good songwriter writing for his time?
He was writing for the deadline on Tuesday.
right.
He was. As one day we were listening to a recording of a live recording of the first tryout of the show, My One and Only, which premiered here in Boston. Mm-hmm. And it was I made a home recording, you know, from the audience. And the audience was screaming and applauding, and Ira started laughing. I said, "What are you laughing about?" He said, "I wrote these songs in the 20s and 30s. He said, they weren't supposed to last. And he thought it was like he was pulling one over on people, that these songs were still appreciated.
Why did he think they lasted when a whole lot of top 40 fodder had come and gone?
Well, he thought that they lasted because of the ability to express something that was a heightened expression of human emotion, of the human condition. Their job was to always find a different way of saying I love you. I mean, that is what 99% of the songs are about. And it was always trying to find a new way of expressing that oft-expressed emotion. And also the wit, the cleverness, the humor, the jokes, all of those things that were put into the songs, they had constant surprises in them, lyrically, but also musically. There was a certain level of craft and ability to create something that touched the heart as well as the mind. And that is something that he was very proud of, because these guys were all friends and women. They all would share their work with each other, and they were all trying to outdo each other in a fun way or a friendly way. Because
can you top this?
Yeah, they and how many songwriters get together and hang out today and play one song for another? They're afraid of a lawsuit or plagiarism or something, or they can't stand the thought that someone could write better than they could.
But there they were, in a lot of them in that kind of tight New York knot.
Yeah, and in Hollywood, too.
In Hollywood, too.
Yeah.
On Broadway and beyond, making music that would last and last and last. Michael Feinstein, it's great to have you with us. And Keith Lockhart, conductor of the Boston Pops, we're talking today about the Great American Songbook. You can join us. Do you go back to this music? Why? Is it nostalgia? Is it romance? Is it the music on its merits? And what makes the Great American Songbook great? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Getting to know you, getting to know all about you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Great American Songbook, the classics, the standards, and what made them great, with Boston Pops conductor Keith Lockhart and five-time Grammy nominee singer-pianist Michael Feinstein, songbook revivalist. You can join the conversation this hour. What makes the Great American Songbook great? What was at work in our culture that produced this music? Will it outlast Lady Gaga, Beyonce? Young listeners, does it speak to you or not? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Little Bing Crosby behind us right there from the songbook. Michael, Keith, we've got a lot of feedback here online. Here's a website comment says, I remember a snippet of Catcher in the Rye where Holden is in a club in New York and describes Cole Porter's Just One of Those Things as a song that's so good that you can't ruin it no matter how badly you play it. Keith Lockhart, please comment.
I don't think the song exists that you can't ruin. I've heard some very good efforts at it at one point or another. It's certainly true that as we used to say about Beethoven, no matter what you do to Beethoven, he will live on. And the same thing is true with these great songs. People have punctured them. The trend in popular music for everybody to do their own standards album is a example of that. Some of them work much better than others, and some of the vocalist voices are much more appropriate, and stylistic takes are much more germane to the music that's being performed.
Michael, what about interpretation over time? I mean, Keith's right. I mean, some of the sort of old standard singers are back and very popular, and popular with young listeners now. Tony Bennett and a whole lot more. But what about interpretation? We can listen back, thanks to the miracle of recording. Has it changed a lot, or do people essentially still reach for the same target when they go at the classics?
Changed dramatically. Dramatically is how it's changed, and it's very interesting to hear the progression of how a song is interpreted. For example, I've Got a Crush on You is a song that was done as a fast-paced da-da-da-da-da-da. It was a one-step. That's how it was done on Broadway, Fast and Furious.
This is George Gershwin, lyrics by Ira Gershwin, back in the musicals Treasure Girl and Strike of the Band, 28 and 30.
What a cue.
Yeah, wow. What a cue.
Yeah, and it was done fast-paced, and then Lee Wiley and then Sinatra sang it as a ballad. And 10 years after it was written. Lee Wiley did it 20 years later in the late 40s. Sinatra recorded it, and it became one of the most famous Gershwin standards. But it was done
slowed down.
And Ira sometimes liked to hear his songs done differently as he changed with the times. Other ones he liked to hear up, exactly as he wrote them. But something like "Crush on You," he eventually liked it much better as a ballad.
Let's hear you performing it, Michael Feinstein. This is from your album, The Sinatra Project. Frank Sinatra, well, move over. Here's Michael Feinstein with "I've Got a Crush on You."
I've got a crush on you, sweetie pie. All the day and night time, hear me sigh. I never had the least notion that I could fall with so much emotion.
Definitely taking the tempo down. Is there something about the structure of these songs that makes them more open to a wide range of interpretation? I mean, could you do the same thing with a current pop hit? You might not even recognize it if you changed it this much, tempo-wise.
That's the fun of it. The fun of it is seeing how it can be reimagined but stay true to the intentions of the writers. It's quite an amazing thing because the songs are incredibly malleable, and they are picked up by young singers and new singers. I mean, Lady Gaga sang "Someone to Watch Over Me" on the
mm-hmm.
Today Show.
Mm-hmm.
But they are infinitely adaptable in a way that is, I think, unique to this body of work.
Let's bring our listeners in. Charleston, South Carolina, Rudy is calling. Hi, Rudy. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, I have a very simple question. To me, it seems that Hammerstein, Hart, Gershwin, all were perhaps musically more trained. Has this training gone away? Does a composer no longer need to know the basics of harmony? This is a question for the conductor of the Boston Pops. Was there involved in earlier times a craft involved in smithing a song or putting a song together that is no longer there?
Rudy, let us pick it up, and I'm very glad for your call. Keith Lockhart, what about simple training? Is that at work here?
Well, I think there was certainly a craftsmanship to songwriting that is not always the case in all contemporary songwriters, but you have to remember that in that period of time, there were people, Kurt Weill, for instance, trained in the most stringent European conservatory training. It started his life before he fled the Nazis in the 30s as a composer, a straight down the middle 20th century German classical composer. People like Irving Berlin couldn't really ever read music. And supposedly he could only play piano in one key. Michael can tell us that.
So we can't say he was classically trained.
and he would. In fact, this is a great story because when he got successful, he realized he needed to be able to play in different keys. So he had a piano built with a clutch on it that would allow him to continue to play the keys of F sharp major.
Wow.
And the strings would move underneath it so he could play in any key and check out the.
So
other
what?
Keys.
So what about training? Is it the Kurt Weill standard that made this happen, or Irving Berlin, which maybe the equivalent today is you pick up GarageBand software and you're off to the races?
Well, it in the case of Berlin, that's extraordinary. He had incredible talent and a genius. But there still was a certain kind of training in that he evolved. He evolved as a writer, and he was determined to improve his craft.
His training was 1,500 songs or so, right?
Experience there, but it means you don't have to have the Kurt Weill style training. You didn't have to have it to pull it off.
You have to have the discipline, though. And I think one of the things that American Idol makes people believe is that you don't have to learn your craft. And that's dangerous. But it's not about the technology. I mean, like you talked about GarageBand mm-hmm. or stuff. I mean, you can use any technology. It's someone will come along who is brilliant, and they learn how to use it in a way that makes it fresh and new and brilliant.
You worked with Gershwin in and after the rock and roll era, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
What did he think about that? Sort of, which saw itself as a successor in some ways. You know, in the day, it was to roll over and push off stage this old stuff. Mm-hmm. How did he look at it?
Ira wasn't threatened by any kind of music because he was secure in what he had done. I remember there was an article in the New York Times that compared Elvis Costello's lyrics to Ira's. So Ira had me get some Elvis Costello recordings, and he listened to them, and he said, "Well, I don't see the comparison. You know, I don't get it. But I'm glad they mentioned my name. You know, that kind of thing.
Just spell it right."
Yeah, I mean, he just worked in such a specific craft, and rhyming was all important to him.
Right.
And the loss of rhyming to him was the destruction of one of the major tenets of what made the songs great.
There was a period, Keith Lockhart, when that destruction was kind of thought to be the goal. Rock and roll, bring it on, you know, sweep out all this sort of soft violins and be gone.
Roll over Beethoven.
Yes.
Isn't that the case in the history of almost any thing that becomes institutionalized?
As a young person, did you think this music would be back?
As a young person, I always loved this music. But
I
had all the Queen albums and Led Zeppelin and the stuff that was of the time when I grew up as well, and I appreciate a great deal of that material as well. It's just that this stuff immediately I thought, well, this stuff never. The great thing about this stuff is it never really went away. It goes through phases and fads, but basically it's always there, and there is a great sized group of people who appreciate it.
Here's Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney in the film Babes on Broadway singing "How About You." This is Ralph Freed and Burton Lane from the 1941 film. Let's listen.
I like New York in June. How about you? I like a Gershwin tune. How about you? I love a fireside when a storm is due. I like potato chips, moonlight, and motor trips. How about you? I'm mad about
you. There you go, Judy Garland, and how about you?
It's
Mickey Rooney would come
in. Not
well
represented in that.
No, not much there. Sorry, Mickey. You know, one of the things that we've become used to now is people, you know, lyrics that you do not hear, that you cannot understand. Everything's articulated the whole way through. Now there's a sort of a impressionistic brush with a lot of lyrics. Mm. When did that begin to change, Michael?
It started in the late 40s and into the 50s, you know, with pop records where it was more about the sound.
Mm-hmm.
It was more about the production of the recording. And Mitch Miller, of course, is considered the great villain of popular music in that he started making records with odd-sounding things like harpsichord, and he put in these things that were just about the sound of the record, the production of the record, and he didn't care about the song. He cared about how it would sound as a record, and gimmicks and hooks and repetition.
Mm-hmm.
And he's famous for having made Rosemary Clooney sing "Come On to My House" and Sinatra sing "Mama Will Bark" as a duet with Dagmar, which incidentally Sinatra had in his contract that he could approve everything he recorded. So it's so it's a myth to say that he was forced, but he was told by these guys, hey, these will make a lot of money and this is what we'd like you to do. So he agreed. But it was really Mitch Miller who, Joe Stafford. I interviewed Joe Stafford and I said, in the 50s you had to sing a lot of songs that were not as good as things you'd sung earlier. She said, well, let's just get right down to it. Mitch Miller. She said,
bottom of barrel.
Yeah.
But I wonder about the earnestness of articulating every word, especially jazz singers today. There's a lot of singing where there's freedom as well in being able to just use a broader sort of coloration brush and scat and all the rest.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Keith Lockhart, did these singers see this as a beautiful music? Could it sometimes be a lockbox?
Well, I think it's you're right that something elemental has changed in not the intention of the song. In the Great American Songbook, the greatest songs in the American Songbook, the intention of the song is to deliver the lyric, and that is not always true anymore. But I would say, on the other hand, if you're looking, you asked a question I never answered about what goes on. Is this an ongoing thing? I think it is. We're not in the position to judge yet. I think if it's played for our great grandkids and they say that song just grabbed me immediately, then we know it's made it into the canon. But Stephen Sondheim, Send in the Clowns. Or all of his work is about delivering the lyric. And I think there are some obvious choices. If I had to be a betting man, I would say, you know, Send in the Clowns 25 years from now, everybody will say that's in the Great American Songbook.
Let's go to Seth in Salem, Massachusetts. Seth, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And hello. good luck tonight to be at both shows. My question is...
Oh, Seth is breaking up on it, and I'm sorry for it, but I have a little note here in advance of his call asking about Sinatra. And what inspired you, Michael, about Sinatra in the Great American Songbook? Why that way in? And what was Sinatra's sort of contribution to the realm of interpretation?
Sinatra changed the way these songs are interpreted. Sinatra changed the face of the Great American Songbook by taking songs that had been written in some cases 10, 20, 30 years earlier and finding a new way to interpret them with Nelson Riddle. He evolved this sort of swing big band style that was fresh for the time and still is fresh. And so Sinatra essentially changed or was the transition from hearing these songs done more ballad-like and more traditionally to a way that gave more freedom of interpretation and reinvented many songs like Lady is a Tramp, which is something that he turned into a swing number, which drove Richard Rodgers crazy until Richard Rodgers saw his royalty check for it. But the point is, but the point is that he changed fundamentally how they're done, and that's why I wanted to approach his overall style approach to the songs. I didn't want to imitate him, but just the sensibility was very different with him.
The freedoms that he took with the music? Or the intimacy of him famously at the microphone?
The phrasing was different. The arrangements, well, it's like when he did The Song Is You. Originally, it was a beautiful Kern ballad. Still is, I hear music when I look at you. He's gorgeous. But he did, I hear music when I look at you.
Yeah.
And he took songs that we never thought we would hear up tempo and made them work that way. Like Fly Me to the Moon, which is still prefer as a ballad. He would fly me to the moon, and now 90% of the people who do Fly Me to the Moon do it as up tempo. Well, Bart Howard, who wrote it, told me he always wanted to hear it the way he wrote it, as a waltz.
Yeah, I was going to say they do it up four even more.
Yeah, exactly. Yes,
drive that song.
Yeah. So it was what Sinatra did to essentially combine two great. I mean, the big band era, the big band movement,
the snap
in popular music, and the Broadway song.
Yeah, that's fair. That's a good point, because he started his career singing with
as
big
a band
bands.
Singer.
Yeah, and then he
took
became
that sensibility,
absolutely,
to different material.
Absolutely, yeah.
Let's go to Brian in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Brian, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
A tremendous fan of all three of you gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
You have great taste.
I wanted to we brush over this term. These songs are in the Great American Songbook because they're timeless. And it strikes me that the best of them really are. If you sing a lyric like, hey there, you with the stars in your eyes, there's nothing that links that to the 30s, the 50s, the 70s, or whatever it is. And you'll hear 1,000 interpretations of that fantastic lyric. But if you take a song that was hugely popular at the time, but is really mired in its own time, you don't hear the reinterpretations. Nobody's changing the tempo and doing a ballad version of Gasoline Gus and His Jitney Bus. It's just, I think
maybe not.
But if you can hum a few bars,
not on my iPod anyway.
But perhaps if the times go as they are, we'll all be on a jitney bus and it'll be popular again.
Right.
But I think there is that timelessness that we sometimes just gloss over and say it. Oh, they're timeless. Well, yeah, they really are.
Brian, let us pick it up there. I'm sorry, but we've got a break coming up right here, and I apologize, Brian. But on this point, maybe they're great because of all the sifting and shifting and sorting that's been done. I mean, a lot of songs from this time we don't sing anymore. The ones that we do are some small percentage of everything that was made.
If you look at the hit parade lists of all the songs that were the big hits, a lot of them have not survived. Many of them have not survived. And Cole Porter had a lot of timely references in his songs, and some of those songs have disappeared.
You're the pants on a Roxy Usher, though? I mean, there's still...
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's true. I mean, he wrote very specifically Porter. I mean, Ann Hampton Calloway said that Cole Porter wrote blues for rich people.
Yeah. Well, they'll survive. They will survive. Michael Feinstein, Keith Lockhart, please stand by. We're looking at the Great American Songbook, and you know Ethel Merman behind us here, Broadway with a Big Effect. You can join the conversation, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back with much more.
They are low, even when the turkey that you know will fold. You may be stranded out in the cold. Still, you wouldn't change it for a sack of gold. Let's go on with the show. Let's go.
Someday, when I'm awfully low, when the world is cold, I will feel a glow just thinking of you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the great American songbook. Fred Astaire behind us there, The Way You Look Tonight.
With Oscar Peterson.
Yes, Oscar Peterson beautifully on that piano. Of course, it's from...
Oh,
let's just listen.
With your smile so warm and your cheeks so soft, there is nothing for me but to love you. Just the way you look tonight.
Oh boy, what a combination. How great. Keith Lockhart, the conductor of the Boston Pops, is with us in the studio today. They're performing the great American songbook tonight, tomorrow. Michael Feinstein is with us. He'll be right in the middle of it, the great singer, pianist, songbook revivalist, five-time Grammy nominee. You can join the conversation this hour. What do you think? Will they be singing these songs in another 100 years? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. We've got all kinds of comments here online. Kate says she'll take any of it when sung by Betty Carter or Ella or Sarah or Johnny Hartman. Kurt says, I love Cole Porter's List songs. You're the top. Second favorite, Anything Goes, is, well, the top, he says. And then a question, maybe a good one off of what we just heard there. Of course, that was Jerome Kearns and Dorothy Fields, The Way You Look Tonight. And Liz asks, can you discuss the effect of the singer-songwriter approach versus those who wrote for other singers? Old school pop had a division of labor, which is much less common these days, she says. What do you say?
It's changed dramatically with singer-songwriters writing their own material because they don't write the songs for other people to sing. Mm-hmm. But some of them still step out, you know, like Billy Joel or Elton John and such. But these songs were absolutely written by writers who were dedicated songwriters, and then they were taken up by other people and performed.
Does that change the way a song ends up being structured?
Yes, it does, because sometimes songs are very specifically written by an artist for their own purposes and also for a record, where a lot of songs are built in the studio, you know, where they'll take months to layer them and build them. I remember being at the Warner Brothers music offices, and there was a guy who was sitting in a cubicle tearing his hair out because he was listening to a pop record and trying to figure out a way to create sheet music, so that, you know, to print sheet music, because it could not be transcribed into a piano score.
Just too much of a mush.
Well, the production and the sounds that were not
that's not replicable in anything other than the studio, where you can layer things on one track at a time.
Exactly.
Bohemian Rhapsody comes to mind.
Right.
An absolute masterpiece
of
the rock, but you can't just go sing it.
So does that mean it can never be in a classic songbook? Because how will you do that?
I don't know.
You know, how would you lay
it down? It's not the kind of thing
you
whistle singing, except for, you know, the headbanging parts of it. It's not the kind of thing you whistle walking down the street.
Right.
I don't know, but there are people, certainly singer-songwriters like Carole King.
Exactly.
Whose music has been taken by dozens of other performers and sometimes has been written specifically for them.
Yes. And Neil Sedaka. Neil Sedaka has written some gorgeous songs that have lasted. The Hungry Years, Breaking Up Is Hard to Do.
Which, sure.
Yeah. So it's just less likely these days, but I think there are still songs that will last. And then, of course, there are the theater writers. John Buccino, Adam Gettle.
Hard at work.
Yeah, and writing beautiful songs, but they're not heard on the pop airwaves.
Well, that's part of the change, isn't it? Is the lack of crossover.
Absolutely.
What happened in the 20s and 30s is everything came together. The beginning of the record era, the ubiquitousness of radio as a disseminator for entertainment.
Get it out there.
The big band era where popular music took on a very, you know, substantial sort of thing. And Broadway, people listening eagerly to Broadway shows to pick out from them the next three big top 10 hits.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a little Duke Ellington in here. Speaking of big band, here's It Don't Mean a Thing If It Ain't Got That Swing.
It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. It don't mean a thing. All you got to do is sing. It makes no difference if it's sweet or hot. Just keep that rhythm, give it everything you got. It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing.
Ivy Anderson in those muted trumpets having a good time back and forth there. Ivy Anderson singing. Of course, 1931 composition. Irving Mills wrote it. Music, the lyrics, music by Duke Ellington. Lorraine in Boston is calling. Hi, Lorraine. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. What a pleasure. Mr. Lockhart, I have enjoyed you over the years here in Boston.
Thank you.
And Mr. Feinstein, welcome to Boston, and I appreciate all your great work.
Thank you.
I wanted to mention how the Great American Songbook is going very, very strong still today, and that it's also represented in instrumental works. And I wanted to mention a compact disc that's been put out by Andy McGee, a professor at Berkeley for 40 years, in conjunction with Claude Diallo, a recent graduate. And it's very much in the vein of the Great American Songbook. And it's terrific.
Lorraine, we hear it, and we you're all over it, and we appreciate your call. Let me ask you on your instrumental point. I mean, this is interesting. What works? We got the Boston Pops conductor here, so it's a good question for the way the Great American Songbook flows into instrumental presentation versus, I don't know, you name it, any other, you know, many other genres that have music. I mean, lyrics and music in their inception. But when you come to an instrumental presentation of these songs, is there something about the clarity or the construction that offers itself for them?
Well, it's actually a problem that's kind of central to what the Boston Pops does, mm-hmm. because what we look at, you know, even though the Pops is 125 years old, Arthur Fiedler, in many ways, was the start of the Pops in 1930, and he created a formula where the orchestra would play light classical or even really true heavy symphonic sort of repertoire the first part of the concert, then do transcriptions of popular tunes, very rarely with a singer singing to them. And what the difficulty is you have to figure out which kind of tunes resonate with an audience without the words attached. Mm. Especially in current popular music, there are very few things I can do. And there are things, Paul Simon tunes and things like that Carole King. But so many of them, people say, gee, I wish you guys had an arrangement of that. And I say, without somebody singing the words, without a vocal line on top of it, you wouldn't recognize this song. There's not enough recognizable melodic topography to it.
But you'll be there, Michael Feinstein, tonight, bringing the recognized melodic lyric to it. Still, there's a lot of structure in these songs that, for many of them, does make them stand right up without the singer. Sorry to say.
Well, no, it's absolutely true. There's incredible craft just in the music itself. One of the things about performing with an extraordinary orchestra like the Pops is that it's important to me to bring arrangements that are up to the standard of what the orchestra is accustomed to playing, because the arrangements themselves have to be fully formed and use the forces of the orchestra. Otherwise, it's pointless to do it.
But there's an interesting, there's an interesting thing in that, that some of our grand arrangements of wonderful tunes that everybody knew in the 40s and 50s don't work anymore because they don't have a voice with them. Because people, they lost that
thread in their minds.
People, when they listen to an instrumental, put the words in their head. Mm-hmm. And for instance, we just did we have a wonderful Jack Mason Berlin portrait that has Always in it.
Right. I'll be loving you Thursdays, sure. Always.
But people don't know the words to that song anymore.
How do you test for that? Do you bring in 20-year-olds and stand them up and say, do you know what we're
I ask my wife. She's a little younger. I say, if she doesn't know the song, I figure that I start getting the danger zone.
Let's get another here. This is The Song Is You, Michael Feinstein singing again from his Sinatra project.
Why can't I let you know the song my heart would sing? Beautiful rhapsody of love and youth and spring. The music is sweet, the words are true, the song is you.
Okay, there's great Oscar Hammerstein, Jerome Kern. Beautiful stuff you're singing. That's from 1932, Music in the Air. Boy, you make it really move. Let me play right up against that a song that brought the house down at the Grammys this year. Talk about popular music, and I want to just get your response. Here's CeeLo Green and Gwyneth Paltrow. Okay, Maestro, it's been way up there in the pop charts. I don't know, it brought the house down at the Grammys this year. You going to be playing that in 50 years at the Boston Pops?
Well, I happen to see that.
He's already played it.
Right.
With different lyrics.
Exactly. I happen to see that production on the Grammys, and I think that I'm glad for their success. I think it was much more about the kind of movie set production that went on at the Grammys than the actual song behind it. But what strikes me about that song is the incredibly retro nature of that song. It sounds like, what would you say, 60s Motown, basically? I mean, it has that kind of thing going on with it. It certainly does not sound like a 2011 song.
That's very true. But the melody itself literally is the same melody that's been used for hundreds of songs. If you didn't have that lyric, you would not be able to identify that song.
So,
because that literally is a plagiarism of coin. It's almost like blues. It's almost like a tradition.
So No Way, No How. You don't see this one standing up for the ages.
No.
Well, let's try this one.
Oh, no.
Willie Nelson.
Make us sit in judgment now?
I don't think you'll have to.
Well, just because it's not musically original. I mean, if it was original, absolutely. I mean, it's not bad. I mean, it's very...
It's got a lot of enthusiastic response.
No, it's fun. It's fun. I'm just speaking in terms of the actual music itself. It's not something that's new.
Well, let's take it down to Hoagy Carmichael then. 1927, here's Willie Nelson, Stardust.
Nightingale tells his fairy tale of paradise where roses grew. Though I dreamed in vain, in my heart there always will remain my stardust melody, the memory of love's refrain.
Willie Nelson with Stardust. I mean, he's great. It's great. It goes on and on. It's amazing to me that it's 1927. I don't know. Somehow it seems absolutely alive.
And I love it. I mean, I love that rendition of it. It's not a snobbery thing. It's not about you have to sing this like a Judy Garland or a Frank Sinatra or somebody like that. He's made it his own. It sounds like Willie Nelson. It's delivered really sweetly. And
There's honesty about it.
And that's, you know, that's what I mean about that, you know, more than surviving, being exalted by having people totally from outside of the popular song Broadway sort of world take it on and make it work.
Yeah. Here's a web comment from Aaron a couple of minutes ago. He says, I'm 34, and the main reason I have a grasp of the importance of many of these standards is because advertisers and screenwriters constantly use them in their work, mm-hmm. either small screen or large. I know songs like Autumn in New York from watching Frasier on Cheers sing it, for example. As long as the work is constantly reinforced by other media, they'll remain in circulation and hence timeless. I mean, it does make you wonder, though, if there's something, well, then why do the advertisers and screenwriters go to it again and again? There does seem to be something tied up with something elementally American in an appealing sense that brings people back to these. They move people.
Well, to evoke romance, they always go back to the old songs for the movies, particularly, because you can't evoke that same kind of response with other types of music. It has a seminal connection to the heart.
What does that mean? Do we not have that romance? We recognize it. We like it when we hear it. But was there a style of romance that's just beyond our more jaded era?
Yes.
An innocence. It's hard to put your finger on, but you're absolutely right. When somebody wants to put something very pure and innocent out in the way of love, they go back in time.
Pure, innocent, but also a sophistication in there. You know, it's a time when people are wondering about this country's future and, you know, best days behind us and all that. I know for some generations they look back to this music and they say there's proof positive.
It's also a communal experience. There's a communal response to that music.
But you said that before and I wasn't sure why, because today everything is lots of people listen to all these
things. But not everybody.
Because it was one radio channel.
God bless America. Everybody knew. Right. You'll never know. Everybody knew. Mm-hmm. There's no business like show business. Everybody knew. Even the cast albums of Broadway shows, everybody had the cast album of Gypsy, of The Music Man, of My Fair Lady.
Today, and now I don't know what you've got in your earbuds. Kind of.
Exactly. Maybe, I mean,
it's almost like we're drowning in choice to a certain extent.
Yeah, I mean, those were the. When I was growing up, everybody bought cast albums, not just gay people.
Now everything's segmented.
And television shows, variety shows had songs that everybody related to, regardless of the generation. Now you can't do a variety show where everyone can relate to the music. It's not possible any longer.
What's on your playlist tonight, Keith?
Gee, you're going to have to ask Michael that. We haven't gone over Michael. Rehearsal yet, but I will say from our end of the coin, we're doing some iconic American music, including music by George Chadwick, one of the first highly recognized late 19th century American composers, Dvorak, New World Symphony, The Largo, some Copland, Buckaroo Holiday, and I'm also told on some Sousa and some Gershwin and some Shall We Dance. But from Michael, we'll be singing with us Luck Be a Lady, I Thought About You, The Way You Look Tonight, Brazil. Well, that might not be American songbook. Yeah. All My Tomorrows, Begin the Begin, For Once in My Life.
That sounds like the list. That sounds like the list.
And more.
All that and more. It's been great to be with both of you. Michael Feinstein, we didn't get to talk about it, but with the Center for the Performing Arts in Carmel, Indiana, I know it's quite a robust center right there. Thank you so much for coming in today.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
And Keith Lockhart, conductor of the Boston Pops. Wonderful to have you. Good luck with all your performances.
Tom, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
And off we go. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
When most guys today, that woman prize today, are just silly gigolos. So though I'm not a great romancer, I know that you're bound to answer when I propose. Anything goes.